I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers. My guest today is one of rock and roll's legendary mystery men. After gaining the attention of the entire world for writing Barry Maguire's Eve of Destruction, he followed with a string of gold records writing hits for Johnny Rivers, The Turtles, Herman's Hermits, Terry Black. He even had a song performed on the Flintstones. And there was a guy named Steve Barry. But P.F. Sloan disappeared from the public eye and was such a recluse that his very existence was questioned. Did he really exist? Was he a real person? Well, his autobiography, What's Exactly the Matter with Me?, co-written by playwright S.E. Feinberg, finally sets the record straight. Not only is P.F. Sloan a real person, but he's really cool. Sloan rode the rock and roll roller coaster and survived hanging out with rock royalty, and he's here to tell the story only he can tell about the struggle, the glory, and the recovery from the glory days of rock and roll. P.F. Sloan joins me in just a moment. Hey, but first, if you really like what you hear today, tell a friend. Be sure to visit our website at deepdishradio.com. If you go to that page, there's an email link and you can connect directly with me. Also follow us on Twitter at Deep Dish Radio and be the first to learn who our next guest is going to be. This is an exciting time to join the Deep Dish family, and we'd love to hear from you and have you join us on our social media. Heck, there's even a Facebook fan page. Look for Deep Dish Radio on Facebook. I'll be reading your emails live in upcoming shows, so make sure to make them good. Spelling counts. And now, P.F. Sloan.
It's Deep Dish Podcast. Subscribe today and tell a friend about Deep Dish Podcast with Tim Powers. With Tim Powers.
One of the first things that really struck me was you, Phil Sloan has been blessed by some of the icons of cool. You know, you tell the story about James Dean, about Elvis, about John Lennon calling you and apologizing. You're blessed by Mick and Keith and Lester Bangs. That's a pretty strong through line. Is there something within you that just attracts that kind of person to you?
Wow.
I know. It's heavy.
You know, it's either fate, destiny, or you know, just outright luck. But you know, when you're traveling through Oz, you know, you're bound to meet a lot of fellow travelers. The beautiful thing about all these people is that they all seem to be way less taken with themselves than average people are taken with themselves. In other words, they really felt like they were just ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances.
Which is, it's difficult for those of us outside the fishbowl to really understand, you know, to think Elvis doesn't walk down the street every day thinking, hey, I'm Elvis. it's pretty amazing. But you met him very early in his career. Are you, would you kind of walk us through that story a little bit?
Sure. Where would you like to start from?
Well, let's talk about the kid with the guitar walking into the music store.
Yeah, you know, it had to have been, you know, a destiny kind of story, where a kid comes face to face with his angst of not really wanting to be what the family wants him to be.
Right.
And Elvis is the hero in the story who is just too big to ignore. So I was a young kid, 12 years old. Father was a pharmacist, and it was pretty much understood that I was, you know, going to carry on the family tradition.
Right.
He had bought me a guitar from a local music store, and I had gotten on the bus that that week after I had it, I think, and went up to the music store to learn how to play the guitar. And the amazing thing about it was that the store was closed with two cops standing out front to guard the doors, like 100 teenage girls being held back by police. I knew something was up, but I had no idea what. And since I was carrying a guitar, they let me into the shop. I don't know why, thinking I was a musician, I suppose.
At 12. you're a 12-year-old member of the Jordanaires.
Yeah, one of the midget Jordanaires, I guess. So I go in there, and the store is empty. And I'll tell you honestly, my first thought, I'm not proud of it, was to rob the place blind.
Sure.
You know, stick as many records as I could. But I got over that thought and went over to the only place that was lit since the store was dark, and that was the music instrument section. Went in there, talked to the old guy that was behind the counter. He must have been 25. And as he's talking to me, Elvis comes walking downstairs and asks me if I want to learn how to play this guitar. And that was the beginning of the meeting with him, which changed my life forever.
Wow. Wow. Now, you know, you pick up your guitar, and, you know, everybody who's been bitten by the rock and roll bug, from fans to musicians to songwriters, you know, they always remember that artist or that record that tipped them off. And you had mentioned in your book that Elvis didn't figure as big in your universe as some other artists. You know, you knew, obviously you could not avoid who Elvis was. You knew exactly who he was. Your mom and your sisters were fans, but your sister was fan. But you know, who was it that tipped it off for you, that made the guitar the thing that it was?
You know, you hit it exactly right. You know, I didn't think of it till this moment. Elvis was a girl thing. You know.
Yeah.
At least where it was, where I was in Los Angeles. You know, it might have been different in the South. And in the movies, they portray, you know, 18, 19-year-old guys wearing, you know, black leather jackets and, you know, greasy hair. So, you know, but for a 12-year-old, Elvis was about women. You know, I don't really recall. Elvis had something to do with it, sure. The guitar, I mean, I can't really think offhand who it was. Buddy Holly, I mean, I was 12 years old, pretty much listening to my sister's music collection from downstairs. So I'd been listening to, I don't know, The Platters, Little Richard, Buddy Holly.
Right.
She was pretty eclectic, but Elvis was the main guy.
When you get the guitar, you look around and you're 12 years old and you start seeing the female adulation for Elvis, you know, was that part of the appeal for you, or was it really all about the music?
At that point, to be really honest, yeah, there was the idea of, you know, I was a really overweight 12-year-old pudgy kid, and I think I wanted female attention. It wasn't till later that the music kicked in. You know, I think it might have been the Everly Brothers, now that I think of it.
I could see that. Wow.
You know, the Everly Brothers weren't teenage idol, per se. You know, they seemed to be about the songs and the music, but their guitars were, you know, sensational. Those Gibson J200s.
They're amazing, yeah. it's just an amazing story, the Elvis thing, and to, you know, realize that Elvis wasn't the Elvis that that those of us who came along later saw. You know, he was huge, no question, but at that time, you know, if you were clever enough, you could get in there and he'd sit down and go, you want to learn how to play that? That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I think what you're trying to say is he really was down to earth.
Yeah.
In every way. And yet, you know, the guy looked like he had come from, you know, Mount Olympus. You know.
When you're 12, I would imagine it really seemed like he had.
Yeah, I mean, just an aura about him, energy, love that I hadn't really experienced. That was the key thing. You know, you can run into, your favorite personalities. You don't necessarily walk away with the feeling of being loved. That's the feeling that I got, and I treasured that. More than anything, I felt loved. And that was something that I believe was missing in my life.
You know, that brings up the next interesting point. One of the through lines, and this is looking at it, you know, 50 years later, but one of the through lines that I saw through the book was Phil Sloan and bullies. And here's what I mean by that. There's an interesting story at the beginning of the book where you stand up to an abusive mom and you threaten her with something very, very severe. Then a few years later, you stand up to Jerry Lasker, who was just as was a bully, with he threatens you with something just as severe, and there was really a sense of empowerment when you stood up to your mom. Are you okay to walking through that story a little bit?
I'll be honest with you, Tim. I haven't really ever talked about it except, you know, going through it in the book. Yeah, but sure, I'm open to it. Sure.
But you see where I'm going with the dichotomy between the two, or the similarity really between the two, where there's you threaten to maim yourself to your mom, and then Lasker basically threatens you and to maim yourself.
Yeah, I can dig it. You know, I'm really looking at it for the first time with you right now. You know what it seemed to be is when you have, I suppose, when you have an experience like that with a parent, which, you know, with many people would be, you know, last a whole lifetime, you know, in considering yourself a victim. I was able to get past that, but I don't think the thing I was able to get past was looking for either a father figure or a mother figure.
Yeah.
You know, someone to give you love and guidance. You know, I was able to get past the violence of it, but, you know, I still think I was vulnerable in terms of believing people in the business as being, parental figures.
Yeah, we noticed that too throughout the book. You are associated with very strong personalities, and you attach yourself to them. And like you called one of your partners like an older brother, and you looked for father figures throughout. And noticed that kind of gives birth to the P.F. Sloan identity that a lot of times you talk about in the third person. And I thought that was fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about the formation of P.F. Sloan as an entity?
Well, I can try.
I know this is a little heavy for a Saturday morning.
I can try because, you know, you're really the only person that has ever really brought this up, so I haven't really looked at it. The observer, okay, you know, just being just talking as an observer, you know, with little vested interest,
right?
Except knowing somewhat of the story, I would say that the P.F. Sloan personality and entity that came about could have been a fearless person who seemed to be strong, aware, and unattached to any of the personalities or the business or the money aspect of it. Just a completely different person than the young Phil Sloan, who was looking, you know, to try and find a way to survive in the world, you know, as yeah. best he could. It seemed that P.F. Sloan really didn't care about that. To him, it was about the music and making a statement, and it didn't really matter who thought of it or what. So I wanted to become P.F. Sloan, you know, full time. But the forces that were there realized that this guy was, this personality was a power to reckon with, and they really, it frightened them and scared them. And, you know, I suppose their only avenue was to destroy it after they had sort of milked it, you know, to the best of their ability.
Yeah, they clamped down pretty hard.
Yeah, that's about as close as I can come to it. I mean, I can't really say that, you know, that the writing entity of P.F. Sloan was completely different than Phil Sloan. I mean, much more enlightened, much more advanced, much more, pretty much what I was looking for, you know, in reading poetry and things like that. It seemed to be have a connection to the higher realms of music.
Sure. And as an artist, you know, you were in such a unique situation. At 16, you're writing pop hit records, right? And then one night you're laying in bed and Eva Destruction and a handful of other songs come in, and you know, there was clearly an artist and a culturally aware entity within you trying to get out, but it seemed like you were kind of trapped in this box where I would imagine the income was pretty tempting to continue to write pop songs, but the artist in you was dying to get out, and based on what I saw in the book, that's kind of where P.F. Sloan came from.
Yeah, you know, Tim, you really put it well. I'll buy that.
It's high praise, good sir. Thank you very much. You know, I may edit this out, but I want to tell you my P.F. Sloan story.
Sure.
You and I shook hands at a signing for the L.A. Nuggets box set that Andrew Sandoval and Rhino put on at Amoeba Records.
Right.
And you performed Halloween Mary live, which was a treat. I got to tell you, it was amazing. And I went through the line, and I think you were at the end of the table. You were at the very end of the table. And
okay.
you signed the book, and I was wearing a Batman shirt, and we were just riffing back and forth. I think maybe you were sitting next to Keith Allison and just joking. You're like, hey, can I sign your Batman shirt? And I'm like, hell yeah. So sitting in my studio right now is a Batman t-shirt signed by P.F. Sloan.
Oh, that's true. That's really cool. Yeah.
You know, the second half of the book gets really intense, because that's when you you know, the money stops, you get involved with some drugs, you move to New York, things really happen. And as I was finishing the book, like the last couple of pages, it really hit me what a survivor you are, because you listed Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Tim Buckley, Fred Neil, Lenny Bruce, folks who self-destructed under the pressure of what they were expected to do. And, you know, you just barely dodged that bullet. And the thing that you said that really pulled you through was that you learned how to love and forgive, right? And
yes.
It struck me as I read that, that was the idealism of the 60s generation, you know, that... you know, it was the summer of love, and it was all about love, and the Beatles were preaching love. And as you dig into the business and the industry that sold us that love, you start to realize that those people were some of them were full of shit, and some of them weren't. But you know, the 70s and 80s and even the early 90s were kind of hard for you. How did you get to that point? How did you get to the point where you learn to love and forgive?
You know, I might not have, simply because the circumstances were set up that there wasn't a lot of love around in my life.
Yeah.
But it just so happened that I was blessed to come into contact with a spiritual guru from India, and that was the beginning of my personal journey of healing from within. And realizing the power of love and forgiveness, which took a number of years and a number of trips to India and spending time there with him, and eventually it took hold, and the healing process came to fruition.
Yeah, your guru from India is yet another powerful, spiritual, amazing, larger than life icon that came to you in an unusual way.
Yes, very.
Can you tell me that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. You know, I can be, you know, average, normal, a victim, hurt, sad. Why is this happening to me? And what did I do? And everyone was around me was saying, you know, it's all your fault. You did something to piss people off. And one night, living with my parents, because I really couldn't afford to live on my own,
right.
This spiritual guru came into my dream by the name of Sai Baba and told me that he would heal me. And it took me about a year to find out who this Sai Baba was,
mm-hmm.
but it happened that a friend that I went to junior high school with had actually been to India with his wife. He had a heart problem that couldn't be healed. He was had a bad heart and was supposed to die, and he had heard about Sai Baba, and he went to go see him, and apparently Baba healed him. And I ran into him serendipitously, and I told him about this dream, and he said, oh, that's Sai Baba from India. And so before I knew it, the money had come in somehow, and I was able to go to India. And he recognized me immediately, though, you know, I'd never been there before, but he knew who I was, and began the healing process. And mind you, there was, you know, 25,000-30,000 people there at a time,
right.
You know. So it was amazing that he knew who I was, you know, and immediately told me, you know, how, you know, he'd been waiting for me and how sick I was, and that, you know, he told these people that were sitting next to me, you know, he's come from Los Angeles and he's very ill. And, you know, it was a mind blower that he knew who I was and cared about me. So maybe I'd done something good in another life. So,
or even this life, Phil. I mean, you don't discount the fact that, you know, the reason there are gold records is because people listen, and you get guys like me who are like, man, he gets it. Cause you were writing songs at 16 that I discovered at 16, 20 years later. And I'm like, this guy gets it. This is fantastic. And so through Sai Baba, you know, the real message of love and understanding kind of came through. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. The I had to forgive myself for whatever I think I had done. And I had to forgive all of those as really being a part of myself, since human beings are all one.
Right.
We're not disconnected. We're all interconnected. So I had to heal everything and know that it was exactly the way it was supposed to be. It was exactly the way it was supposed to be. There was things that I learned, you know, through the exile from music for 30, 40 years that I needed to learn from being here on Earth. So, you know, I began to be able to see it through the eyes of love, and just it may not be the way my personality would want it to be, but it was exactly right for my spirit. So realizing that made it all good.
Yeah, that's what I don't want to say it was missing from the book, but one could expect some bitterness mixed in with these incredible stories that you tell about being P.F. Sloan being clamped down, and controlled and, for lack of a better term, really abused, which caused that 30-year exile. And, you know, rather than bitterness, I as the reader, really started to feel for you, and thought, wow, this is really amazing, and could relate. The story that you tell about hearing Jimmy Webb's song about you resonated because I've actually been to that hot dog stand right next to the Vista Theater. I'm like, I know exactly where that is. I probably sat on that same stool. And and what a snowball that started for you, you know, when you heard that.
Yeah, that that took a lot of years to process.
I bet.
What that was about. You know, in all fairness, it was difficult for Jimmy as well. Every time I run into Jimmy, he's always apologizing to me for writing that song.
Well,
you know, he's saying, I should have asked permission. You know, I didn't do that. I don't, you know. It just so happens that even if it was anybody else's name, it just happens to be a fantastic song, isn't it?
Yes, it
it's
really
hauntingly,
is.
It never gets old. I don't know why that is.
And it's
he captured something haunting in that song.
It
that was timeless.
It really is. And like a lot of the songs that you've written, there aren't bad covers. You know, everyone who's done it has done a really interesting and great job on it. And the same could be said for a lot of things that you wrote as well. I mean, I discovered P.F. Sloan through the Turtles. And I was a senior in high school in 1986, just to give you an idea of what it was. And just fell in love with vinyl a few years earlier. And just started digging through everything that came out between maybe right before Beatlemania to about 1971 and just grabbed everything I could get my hands on. And
right.
Remember getting that Turtles album and looking at the liner notes and going, who is this guy? And it just kind of brought me down the rabbit hole and really discovered some amazing things through trying to find out more about you in this time when you were in exile. So we were out there. Phil, don't worry. We were out there. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
During the exile, one of the things that I found in the book, and another bully you stood up to, is you kind of brought down Eugene Landy a little bit.
Yeah, I was really blessed to play a character in that play. To play a part in that play, you know, it was at a time when I was still in the process of healing. Okay,
yeah,
and I had been friends with Brian Wilson, and you know, because I'd worked with Jan and Dean in the studio for years,
mm-hmm.
and you know, Brian and Jan were very close, and so you know, I'd run into Brian and the Beach Boys, you know, almost every day at the recording studios. And, you know, I loved him, and as much as I loved Jan and Dean, and, you know, I read about the problems that Brian was going through, and I used to pray for him,
yeah.
You know, and ask God, you know, isn't there something, you know, that you can do to, you know, get him free of this madness? But, you know, it went on and on and on and on. I didn't realize it was 9 years, right?
Right.
I mean, and wow, I mean, the way that he was... The way that he was sucking him dry was incredible. So I guess the part that the universe had me set up to play was I get a call from Tim White at Billboard magazine, and this is still at the time where you know, nobody's really sure who P.F. Sloan is. You know
yeah.
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that Eugene Landy could stand up at a press conference and say. You know, when they asked him, you know, how is it that how do you have the cojones, you know, to, you know, write songs with Brian Wilson? And he said, oh, well, he said, you don't know my nom de plume. And they said, what's that? And he says, oh, he says, you know, I go by the name of P.F. Sloan. So everybody just accepted that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a huge amnesia or whatever. But they said, oh, you're P.F. Sloan. Okay, great. So there was one guy who, like, 6 months after he made that statement, one guy at Billboard magazine, Tim White, an assistant editor there, he says, you know, I've got a P.F. Sloan album at home. It doesn't look anything like that guy. And he must have been one of the only people in the world that had it, because nobody questioned it. And he tracked me down and called me up on the phone one day and asked me if I would be willing, you know, to go to court, you know, and say that that this man's a liar and that he's, you know, using my name wrongly. And I told him, yes, I'd be very happy to. So under the threat of that, Eugene Landy, within a week of the article, I'd written a letter to Billboard magazine stating that he was a charlatan, a Rasputin, and a liar.
Yeah.
Within a week to 2 weeks, he had been kicked out of whatever medical part of the AMA or something, but the
lost
psychology,
his license, yeah.
he was stripped of it, and within 2-3 weeks, he was gone. And so that was really a wonderful turn of events.
Quite a victory for you.
Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that. It's great.
Have you seen Love and Mercy? Have you seen the movie yet?
No, I have.
I haven't either.
Have you?
No, I intend to see it, but haven't yet. But apparently the. You know, some folks aren't happy with how they're portrayed. Like Van Dyke Parks isn't happy with how he's portrayed in the movie, but I think Landy's
right.
Pretty accurate. And in fact, I don't even know if there's a P.F. Sloan in the movie or if they even get into that. But
now, yeah, Tim, I'll tell you honestly, I don't know how this sounds, and I don't know if you want to put this on the air.
Okay,
but there is a very strong effort to expunge. P.F. Sloan.
Tell me more about that.
There is that happening. But no, there's no mention of it. And the portrayal of Landy is not exactly the way it happened, but it's Hollywood.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me about the effort to expunge. Are they trying to remove the P.F. Sloan from history, which seems
yeah.
that it would be difficult to do because you're on liner notes and, thank heavens, you got around to writing this book. So those of us who know and have shook hands with you, we know what's going on.
Yes, and I can't even begin to fathom why that is, but when I was in the desert for 30, 40 years, it was basically a field day for the mice. I mean, basically, everybody was standing up and saying, I wrote these songs. I did all this work. I did the producing. I did all that. Johnny Rivers, bless his heart, was saying, you know, I wrote the riffs on Secret Agent. Everyone was taking credit
right.
For all of that. The publishing companies, obviously, who weren't paying me anymore, were very happy with the idea that they didn't have to pay this guy.
Right.
And so, you know, there was this idea, you know, to just expunge him, you know, and that became like, I don't know how to express it or how to say it. It seems like the universe didn't want that. And that's the reason why, the book came out and this, you know, the touring and a new album. But that's, you know, that's one of the darker parts of the music business. Everybody stands up and takes credit for something they didn't do these days. But, so I've been protected from that regard, and I'm very grateful for that.
And still standing and still rocking. The new album came to you in a really interesting way as well. When you were in the desert, and this, you know, the album just kind of appears. I don't want to sell the creative process short, but what I read, and maybe I misinterpreted, but it kind of came to you during a period where you weren't really conscious of its creation. Is that accurate?
Wow. you know, this much I can say, just as, you know, just as a person experiencing, you know, that after the work was done,
yeah,
and it was an intense 10-12 year project, which anyone in their right mind really wouldn't want to get involved in that, because everybody knew that, you know, that we're artists are susceptible to getting involved in a project that is, you know, can be never ending,
right?
You know, and you really have to be in your guard against that, because, you know, it can be so egotistically hidden from you, you know, but you're being obsessed, and it's a fine line between compulsion and obsession. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And you're, so anyway, at the end of this project, which was an impossible thing to do, I don't remember any of it. You know, no, I took notes on a diary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, of the work that I was doing, and I read it now, and it's unbelievable. It's impossible. You know, I mean, I was writing music, and I don't write music, and I was doing things that I had no way of knowing what it is I was doing. So I'm very happy with the finish. I'm very happy with the work, though. And I think, if I can remember from my heart, that I wanted to do music from my heart, for, you know, without, you know, with paying homage to the filters of pop,
right?
You know, but being able to not have someone tell me this has to be done in 6 weeks, or tell me what it is I can and cannot do lyrically or musically. And I just thought for myself, I'd do that just to see if God had given me talent in that regard. So I'm very happy with it. But as I said, I'm going on a bit, but I really don't consciously remember doing the work.
So after 50 years, the creative universe finally let you be who you wanted, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Tell me about the new project and the connection with Beethoven.
Well, it came about serendipitously. I really had been dried up to music. I mean, I listened avidly to music, but I didn't find anything that was inspiring to me anymore.
When you say you were dried up to music and you were listening, and I don't mean to interrupt, but this is kind of, in your own words, when you were on the desert, you know, what you said was that you fortunately kind of missed out on disco, but were you listening when you were, were you listening to music? Were you playing the radio when you were adrift?
You know, I don't recall.
Okay.
You know, there might have been, you know, there were definitely people that would tell me about things, but I really just felt completely burned out from music.
Sure.
Music was just done for me, and that was a sad thing for me, because, you know, growing up as a teenager, I really had it in my mind and heart that I'd always be listening and loving music. Just couldn't conceive of the idea of not listening or loving music.
Uh-huh.
So that completely disappeared for me. And it wasn't until someone took me to a Beethoven concert that all of a sudden that thorny cactus of a heart just broke, and a new heart emerged that was just saying, oh, that's what all this rock and roll is about. That's what all these harmonies are about. That's what the search for the heart and soul of God and music is about. He's captured it. He's got the entire harmony of all of music right within his heart. And I thought, wow. I said, if I'm a musician, you know, shouldn't there be some of that in me as well? You know?
Right.
So I just wanted to explore that.
And you started to find some connections between what you experienced contemporarily and what Beethoven went through. Like, the thing that struck me most, and this may not have resonated as strongly with you because I'm looking from the outside, but Beethoven's pressure to write what was at the time popular music, at the same time wanting to write what burned within his soul, which was kind of the difference between Phil and P.F. Sloan writing at Dunhill.
That is very, very accurate. That's one of the things that led me to keep investigating Beethoven. One of the things that he mentioned was that he was always considered to be a Mozart wannabe. He wrote in his diaries that he will never be accepted as an artist on his own. There can only be one. And that was Mozart, and he's just a wannabe Mozart. The other was that I found out that his favorite instrument was the guitar, and that he had written 400 folk songs.
That's interesting.
And I said, what? This guy wrote folk songs? Yeah, he wrote folk songs, and he always carried a guitar with him. And so all these coincidences, similarities, you know, began to, like, really mount up. And I thought, you know, this guy's calling me, you know. And, you know, I had to take it with a grain of salt because, you know. But, you know, the fact is if you take Beethoven as just another guy and not as a god, you know.
Yeah.
You begin to see his happinesses, his joys, his sadnesses are very similar to all of ours. So I sort of kicked him off the pedestal, which he wanted, and just said, hey, you know, see who I am. See, I'm just a musician like you. And so I began to learn to play the piano by listening to Glenn Gould for about 6-7 years.
Right.
And one night, I'll tell you honestly, Tim, believe it or not, I'm just telling you the experience that I had,
yeah.
Whether you can believe it or not, it doesn't matter. But one night he came to me.
Beethoven came to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know this is going to sound crazy. Believe me, I know this. But imagine I've been working heart and soul day and night for years, you know, looking at his life and his music. And the first words he says to me are, in a huge, thick German accent, is, you don't know how to write music, but shit.
That's beautiful.
Well, thank you so much. Don't you think I know that? So, you know, whether that's real or not, I can't tell you. All I know is that it didn't change my love and feeling for him and his music. It just redoubled my efforts, which I perhaps needed to finish the album. Because one of the lines in the song My Beethoven, which was the only song I was working on for all these years, was praying to God either kill me or finish the song. Just one of the two. I don't care. I mean, how long does it take to write a song? It's just astounding. So, in the end, that song led to a cycle of 7-8 other songs that came about fairly quickly, and so I recorded it, and then found a label for it, and I'm very pleased with it. I think it's the happiest thing I've ever done, but I realize it's like, you know, Dion saying, you know, this new album's the best album I ever made, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it may be, but let's face it, you know, nothing's going to take the place of Ruby Baby.
Well, you know, there's a lot to be said for the artist's heart, and if your heart and soul is in this, and I'll be honest, I haven't heard the new album, but your emotion and your heart and soul is enough to have me get it as soon as we end this. It's a fascinating concept, and as you talk about it toward the end of the book, and as I've heard you talk about it in other places. It's really, really, fascinating. Will there be live performances?
I would love to, but you know, here's the really peculiar thing, Tim. While I was learning how to play piano and playing piano 8 to 10 hours a day for 14 years,
yeah.
I don't remember any of the chords for the songs. I mean, I've tried.
Sure.
I made up a special CD of just the piano parts, mm-hmm. so I could learn them. But I don't know. We'll have to see. It would be amazing to do. I just don't know if I'm capable of it. But
wow.
We'll see.
Wow, that's, the opportunity to see something so close to your heart come alive in front of you, and speaking as a fan and an audience member would be really powerful. At the same time, we're blessed to live in a time when the record is there, you know?
Well, Tim, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say this because it just came through to me. You know, the main goal of this wasn't about me. It was about taking Beethoven back from the elite.
Wow.
It cool. wasn't about Sloan. It was about the fact that Louis, who he liked to be called Louis, because that's what the French called him.
Right.
And they were the only ones that were buying his music, you know, at the time. So he was really earning whatever money he could get and living hand to mouth from the French, and they called him Louis, and he just embraced that. The thing is that Louis liked to play in bars, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, every night he would go and play piano at the bar, and they would call out songs for him to play. So he was a bar piano player, you know? Yes, he played at home, you know, and yes, he wrote things, but basically his heart and soul was, you know, was playing for people in a bar. Today, if you want to go see a Beethoven concert, it's going to cost you $180. And people of all, you know, of the younger generations who, like myself, I identify with them because when I was younger, Beethoven was not presented to me in a positive way. He was forced down my throat with Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And I developed a distaste for it because I didn't like it being shoved on me. So the fact is that he belonged to the elite now, and we're missing out on the roots of rock and roll and the roots of jazz and blues and the real heart and soul of classical music, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't like to listen to classical, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means, and it some of it is just, most of it is just like filler music to me, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not sophisticated enough. But, you know, it doesn't appeal to me. I mean, you turn on one of these local, you know, college stations and listen to, you know, classical music, you know, it's okay. It's like eating too much turkey, you know, puts you to sleep. You know, maybe that's the goal of it. But I can't get into the guy's head who's written it. You know what I'm saying? I don't know what he's thinking about. I don't know what he's talking about, you know. But with Beethoven, I can feel every joy, pain and thought that's going through his mind, and he writes in his diary the truth of music, he said, is being inside the composer's mind and heart, and he allows us that entrance, which is amazing, you know. So you can feel when he hesitates for a moment on a chord to go to the next one.
Yeah.
You could sense that he's not sure where he wants to go, and then when he hits that chord, it's like a triumphant change that he's accepted that it sounds good to him. So it's like a, It's like being in John Malkovich. You know, it's like being in John Malkovich's head and heart. And, you know, that's just one of the beauties of Louis.
That's fantastic. It's really, the way that you talk about Beethoven is the way a lot of your contemporaries and everybody after talks about the folks that we talked about at the beginning of the interview, James Dean and Elvis and John Lennon and Mick and Keith, you know.
Right.
And it seemed like growing up where you were and having those experiences at such a young age, you were prepared to take an icon and remove him from his pedestal and humanize him so that he could say to you, Pierre Sloan, you don't know how to write music for shit. You know, it humanizes yeah. him. That's fantastic. You know, one of the other things that, you know, the world has changed a lot since 64. How have the distribution channels changed for this new the new album? You know, is that something that rings in your universe, or is that something for other people to deal with?
It does touch upon my universe, but there's very little that one can do. I mean, I was just very fortunate to be able to get the record out, which I hadn't ever really expected, because, to be honest with you, my circle of friends really thought that what I was doing was crazy and shit, and, you know, they were basically distancing themselves from me. And it's not that I blame them, it's because from their point of view I was caught up in a compulsion, and they had no idea what it was going to sound like in the end. And it's impossible that it came out so good. It really shouldn't. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Because all these compulsion projects turn out to be just egoistical projects. But there's very, very, very little of that in the project itself. It's just basically the heart of music for me. So the distribution of it, it's on Amazon. It's on foothillrecords.com. It's a small boutique label, but it's been selling constantly for the last year.
Right. Well, and I mean, it's out there, which really
is,
you know, the new digital distribution has almost kind of leveled the playing field. You know what I mean?
Almost, yes. But then again, I remember the goal of this album is really to get you to listen to Beethoven.
Which, from creator to audience, Phil, that's what it's done. I am looking forward to diving in. And I'm a veteran of classical music radio. So, you know, I worked in classical radio for a while and played a lot of Beethoven. And, you know, you're right. On a steady diet, you tend to pot it down and read a book. You know, when you're in the booth for 4 hours a day, you pot it down and read a book or whatever. But to go in and really find, when you say it's the roots of rock and roll and one of the earliest rock and roll songs and one of my favorites mentions Beethoven by name and kind of says, we're here now, back off. To see that as actual genuine, what the hipsters call roots music is really fascinating, and it's a whole different perspective, and I love it.
It is, and that's the only contact that I ever had with Beethoven was Roll Over.
Right,
that was it. But the fact that Chuck Berry was bringing that up to us at 14, it still didn't do the trick. You know, because through high school, those that were listening to the Beatles and the Stones and Elvis, the nerds were not listening to that. They were listening to classical, you know, and
yeah.
they were looking at the Beatles as imitation, you know, classical musicians, you know, but we didn't really know where it was coming from. And if I remember correctly, the first review that actually brought the Beatles into major prominence was one of the British newspapers that compared them to Beethoven.
Oh, man.
And then all of a sudden, all of a sudden the big wigs, the classical wigs were saying, what? How can they say that? So they started listening to the Beatles, and they found that there was something in their music that was creatively genius. So it was Beethoven again bringing the Beatles into the world.
Yep. There are tons of scholarly tomes written, by musicians and critics of music and people who are into the theory of music about, what John, Paul, and George were really doing musically. And frankly, it's over my head. So I,
right.
I stopped reading a lot of that because it seemed pompous. And if you dig it, drop the needle on the vinyl and just enjoy it and shut up.
Really?
Yeah.
You got it, man.
A friend of mine who works in the industry says that there's a magic moment in just about every piece of music, in every record. You know, you take the dopiest Fabian cut, and there's something
right
in there where it just gets you.
Yeah. For example, how he says, turn ma loose.
Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't say the word me. He says, turn ma loose.
Right. I mean,
yeah, there's, I agree. There is something fantastic in every record, whether it's a hit or not. And one other quick thing.
Yeah, man.
Between the war between Beethoven and Mozart, and I don't know if you're aware that it's still going.
Oh, yeah.
It's an ongoing war because they took Beethoven's statue out of because the Mozart people complained. They had a statue of Beethoven in front of the L.A. Philharmonic Hall.
I didn't know that.
And so they removed his statue. They put it in Lafayette Park next to the World War One general. I forget his name. So there's Beethoven standing next to a World War One general. The reason is that the Mozart people objected to having Beethoven's statue in front of the music hall. And here's the way I look at it, because I look at it very objectively, I hope. Mozart was writing what they call stream of consciousness, right?
Right.
Beethoven was agonizing over every chord. If you look at his chord sheets, you'd see he started out with a B flat and then erased it and thought a B flat minor. No, I'll make it a C. No, it'd sound better if it was a D flat. He agonized over every single thing. And I think that's the way most of us are. I don't think we're privileged to that divine grace of just constant, endless flow, from heaven straight to the paper. And yet I found that Beethoven, like Mozart, was given, as Beethoven described, he said, I was given the entire symphony in one flash of light, okay?
Huh.
He said, inside the flash of light was the entire symphony. He said, but it would take me 10 years to decipher the light, but I always remained true to the actual light. So in a flash of light, all the music was given. It wasn't created as we think it's created. In other words, he's saying that it's coming to him as a flash of light. And what he does is agonize, sort of like a Lego thing, to get the right building blocks according to the light that he experienced. Saying, oh, no, it can't be that chord because it doesn't feel right with what the light had given me. So he's doing an amazing job of transferring light into music.
And it comes from the heart and soul more than it comes from the theory and the charts. Is that what
exactly
you're hearing? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. As a lot of other, as lesser kind of, still wonderful. I mean, if you look at all the people that Beethoven influenced, that was another amazing thing to learn, was that you could take 10 chords of Beethoven of any piece, and just as he did with Haydn, he would listen to Haydn and say, oh my God, that's an incomplete symphony just in those 10 bars. I'm going to take those 10 bars and turn it into a symphony. So it was sort of like Beethoven is like this fertile field. You know, you take any 10 bars of him and, you know, they're open to, you know, creating new works of art from it.
And here you are still doing that.
Yes. Shows you the energy is still there.
Are there, on the new album, are there pieces based off of, you know, Beethoven chord changes, for lack of a better term, or are they all coming from a brand new space?
It's a wonderful question. First off, the album is taken from his diaries and his letters. So a lot of the words are his own. All of the feelings are his own, but they seem to match up with my own feelings on a lot of levels. The music is inspired by him, but put through the filter of a pop songwriter, but it's coming from the heart rather than the filter of trying to create a successful song. If that makes any sense.
Of course it does. Of course it does. And that's, you know, that's going to make that album interesting to listen to, because it's such a, you know, the craft and the workmanlike effort that went into, you know, Beethoven pieces, or forgive me for comparing if it's presumptuous, the early P.F. Sloan compositions, has kind of been replaced by a more natural, organic kind of thing, and the skill just kind of is second nature. Am I making sense?
I'm not really sure.
That you've got the building pieces, the skill. You know how to swing a golf club already. You know, you've been swinging
right.
a golf club for enough that when you approach a challenging course, the nuts and bolts kind of come to you automatically.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There were two things in my Beethoven. One is I may have been foolish enough to actually take the Ninth Symphony and write lyric to it and redo it in such a way. Because basically, the Ninth Symphony was basically written in a bar. You know, it's a bar song.
Yeah.
And,
wow.
You know, Beethoven had heard that melody 20 years previously. And, again, studying Beethoven, you realize the insight into a musician, any musician, is that he simply says you never lose a melody. Whether it takes 25 years, 30 years, but you never forget anything you've ever written. So he wrote, you know, maybe a half a page of music, you know, from the bar song, and left it for 20 years. And he said, you never forget. And that is amazing. You know, as musicians, there isn't anything that we've ever written or ever heard that we'll ever forget and not want to use. So I may have been foolish to do that, but it's his feelings in the Ninth Symphony, in called Joy to the Ninth. And the only other time I used a Beethoven actual line, and I struggled with it. There are two things. I struggled with it for 10 years. I know that sounds impossible. It does sound impossible because I don't remember any of it now, but I've got proof that I did it. But I used string lines on Fur Elise. That's it.
Right.
I interwove that in a song, just as just throwing it about, and basically you know, playing the Ninth Symphony was basically it, and I struggled to do the da 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 da.
Of course, of course.
I struggled. In my Beethoven, and then I finally, after all the years, I said, yes, I can own that. You know, it's his, and I can put that in there.
And Louis can't insult your songwriting if you're using him as a foundation.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, Tim, I really do think he was standing behind me on a lot of this. I don't think he's attached to it, obviously, and I don't think he's owning it, but I think he was helping me through that process. And I really look at him as just a wonderful, wonderful human being. I mean, what a sense of humor he had. Nobody knows. All the stuff that's been written about him by Schindler is a lie. Wow. It's all been made up. It's all phony. And Hollywood and everybody else doesn't even care.
It's another thing you can relate to.
Yes. Schindler, do you know that? Do you know that, that everything that Schindler wrote about him is a lie?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do we find the real Beethoven? It took me 20 years to actually discover him. And he is as sweet and as childlike and as wonderful as they said Mozart was. You know, I guess that's inherent in these kind of divine composers, you know?
Yeah. And for lack of a better term, he's kind of a victim of Hollywood too. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And my crazy feeling was that we've got to take him back. He's got to belong to us and not to the elite where they spend $300 for a ticket and we can't go.
You know, how do you see that happening, Phil, with the common man taking possession of something as organic and awesome, but idolized, you know, for lack of a better term, idolized?
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I met a director, Hollywood director, who actually went through the same experiences that I did with Beethoven.
Wow.
He's written a book about him, and he's touring all over the world because he's made a film about him that is really true. Are you aware that every year at Christmas time that they do the Ninth Symphony in Japan, 25 million people are performing the Ninth Symphony? It's called Daiksha or something like that. People study all year long to do the Ninth Symphony, and it's sort of, they don't celebrate Christmas in Japan, they celebrate the Ninth Symphony. Do you know that the prisoners in Allende's jails, the torture centers, the women, when their husbands and their children were taken into the torture centers, these great big, you know, palaces of torture, the women, the wives, the mothers would play Beethoven on their boombox speakers so that their husbands and children could hear this music in the prison. They weren't allowed in the prison. They all gathered outside the prison and played the same music at the same time, loud enough so that they knew that their husbands and children could hear the music and it would save their souls.
That's amazing.
And he's written this book on it, and he told me, really briefly, he was about to commit suicide. He was at the beach, Malibu, and his life was going so bad that he really was comprehending suicide. And he turned on the radio at no particular station at that moment just to hear music before he decided to kill himself. And it was a Beethoven piece, and he didn't even know who it was. But he said that it reached into his heart and soul and said, life is worth living. And he then called the radio station to find out who it was, and they said it was Beethoven. And he felt he was obligated to Beethoven from that moment for saving his life. And he spent the last 10 years now doing talks all over the world, and he's got a documentary out on it. So there's something amazing about Beethoven that we haven't even scratched the surface on.
That's astounding. That's absolutely astounding. And so Beethoven chooses a pop writer to bring it back to the people.
I'm one of many, I hope, because are you familiar with the story of Richard Dreyfuss, the great actor?
Yeah.
When I was in the compulsion of Beethoven, trying to tell wake up people to listen to Beethoven, you know, and they all just hung up on me. You're crazy, you know. I was watching Oprah one day, and Richard Dreyfuss was on. And Richard Dreyfuss had been arrested for cocaine use, and he had been in an accident, nearly got killed. His life was falling apart completely falling apart.
Right.
And he was on the Oprah show, and Oprah was saying to me, "So, Richard, how did you get your life back together again?" And he said, "One word, Beethoven." And she goes, "Beethoven?" He goes, "Yeah." He says, "I was introduced to Beethoven."
Also, the only time in his career Richard Dreyfuss has ever given a one-word answer.
I imagine so. But he went on to say how it changed his life. He listens to Beethoven in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. And he said he's calm and happy and collected, and he feels like he's in touch with the beauty of the universe. So, you know, what a gift we've been given. And, you know, it's not that, you know, I'm anti anyone else. It's just that, you know, we've got this this incredible music that has been hijacked. I mean, Richard Dreyfuss is in his, you know, late 50s, and he's just picking up on Beethoven.
Right.
And it transformed him. I'm picking up on Beethoven, and it saves my life and transforms me. So basically what I'm telling to listeners is, you know, if you find anything worthwhile in this album whatsoever, then go try and listen to Beethoven. That's all.
There you go. You do exactly what I'm about to do, which is head over to Amazon or to foothillrecords.com and download this album right away. The transformation and the journey to get where you are right now is chronicled in What's Exactly the Matter with Me, Memoirs of a Life in Music. And it's a fascinating book. Absolutely great. Thanks, by the way, for the addendum at the end where you go through the compositions, which was a treat for me. You know, where you walk through the P.F. Sloan compositions, which is, obviously I love getting what's going into what's underneath the grooves. So it's fantastic. A great book. I'm looking forward to the album. Phil, anything else you want to let the world know?
No matter where you are in life right now, whether it be good or bad, it's going to change. And the changes, while you're going through them, it's hard to believe. It's always for the better. You can just hold on to whatever love you have for yourself and see that in everyone else. And everything will be all right.
There isn't a better place to end this. Thanks very much, Phil.